listening to the Weekly Discourse on the Man of God Network, featuring a weekly lecture from the classroom of Covenant Baptist Theological Seminary.
All right. Now, we still have about 10 minutes before we get to our break time. So let me do just a brief review of some of the precursors of Puritanism. A brief review of the precursors of Puritanism. Now, remember that this is an overview, and some of these topics will be discussed in much more detail as we move through the week. I'm a bird's eye view guy. I like to see the big picture before I deal with the parts. So I want to give you an overview of the big picture, and then as we work through the week, we'll get the parts. Okay. Now, we could start with Lollardy, the Lollards. This was a dissenting movement within English Christianity from the mid-14th century onward. It's usually identified with John Wycliffe, the morning star of the Reformation. You know that label that's been given to him. Lollardy tended to be a lay movement, and the term Lollard was, like Puritan, a derogatory term. Now, it might be that remnants of the movement of the Lollards endured into the 16th century. And certainly, if we can speak of a movement that we would call the Lollards or the Wycliffe movement, it was a precursor to the Reformation, and it, before the Reformation, introduced a strain of nonconformity into English Christianity. That is, it introduced the idea of protesting against certain doctrines or practices of the church prior to the Reformation. Now, one question is, how closely related was Lollardy to Puritanism? And the answer is, it's very, very difficult to say. Probably not much, if any, but it's open to discussion. The most important thing that we can say about Lollardy is that the idea of dissent was probably its most important legacy. It introduced into the religious climate of the Kingdom of England the idea of dissent to the predominant religious ideas and practices of the day. Right? Now, let's talk about the start of the Reformation. This is fascinating stuff. A Baptist by the name of Edward Terrell, who was the an elder in the Broadmead Bristol Church in London, took copious notes about his church. And in those notes, he incorporated a statement of steps that led to the formation of his own church. His goal is to describe to us the genesis of his own congregation. But it's fascinating how he describes his own congregation in the light of the broader Reformation movement. So I think it's valuable for us to read through, to work through his 12 steps. And it gives us a picture of one man's mind of how his own congregation fits into the process of Reformation. And I think it's typical of how Puritanism viewed its relationship to the events of the 16th and the 17th centuries. Okay, so I put it all on PowerPoint here. I want to read through it with you, then we'll make some comments, and then we'll be done for this session. All right, so if we can get this up on the screen for everybody to be able to read, let's begin here. Now, this is taken directly from Edward Terrell's 12 Steps of Reformation. Remember, he's moving towards the formation of his own church. And this is what he wrote. Thus the Lord led them by degrees and brought them out of popish darkness into his marvelous light of the gospel. Now, that's his introductory sentence. It's actually at the end of a paragraph. But that's how he segues into this. So now we have the 12 steps. First of all, the Lord alone, by his Spirit, not by might, nor by power, opened their eyes and made them cast off the body of false doctrines of the Church of Rome that had so long deceived the nations and made them drunk with the wine of her fornication, worshiping under pretense the true God in a false manner, wresting the Holy Scriptures to their own damnation, saying the real presence of Christ was in the sacrament that signified his body by a transubstantiation, and teaching that man's works merit salvation and works of supererogation, etc. Now, do you know what he's talking about yet? Well, it's not really clear, is it? Notice what he does next. Secondly, the Lord put it into the hearts of some in authority in this nation. Now, that's a clue to what the first point is about. The first point is about Luther and Calvin. It's about the global Reformation. Jeremy, a screensaver just kicked in on this. There we go. And now I've got a blue screen. You got it. Okay. In step one, he's thinking about Calvin and Luther and what happened on the continent. Now notice he brings it across the channel. It's fascinating here. Secondly, the Lord put it into the hearts of some in authority in this nation to cast off the body of the worship of Rome, as well their doctrine, namely the nest of idolaters, even to cast out the monks, friars, abbots, priests, masses, advocation of saints with praying for the deceased, etc. These things were done long before, for which now we would probably use the word gruff, add a G to it and give you the idea, okay? Rough and rough work, God chose and fitted rough spirits to do it, more for their own interest and concern than aiming at God's glory. So through man's own private ends, the wise Lord managed his own good pleasure, witness King Henry VIII. Now we'll be telling the story of King Henry VIII probably in our next session. But you see, Terrell here argues that the Reformation started on the continent and then came to England by the back door through the strange actions of Henry VIII, who wanted to really satisfy his own ends. He wanted a male heir, but he also wanted to satisfy his lusts. And Terrell recognizes that fact, but now we have a Reformation that's beginning 140, 50 years before Terrell through the strange actions of King Henry VIII. Thirdly, it pleased the Lord in these latter days. Okay, now we're moving ahead. Fast forward. It pleased the Lord in these latter days to raise up a people and make them come a step further in the Reformation, even to come from under the skirts of the whore, and to cast off popish scraps of doctrine and worship, the appendices thereof, namely idolatrous holy days, primarily their three great or cardinal masses, namely Michael's Mass, Christ or Pi Mass, thirdly, Candle's Mass, days of their own invention like Jeroboam, together with the multitude of their saints' days, so-called as St. All Souls and St. Midsummer, the folly of which might be shown at large if it might not obstruct the design of a brief narrative how the Lord brought this church out of darkness. Do you feel him? There's the gate. There's the rabbit trail, and he wants to run down it, but the leash is holding him back. Now, I've looked. I have no idea why he calls Christmas Pi Mass. I've tried to figure that out. I've tried to find it. It doesn't appear anywhere in any of my sources. I can't find it in the Oxford English Dictionary. So far as I know, this is the only place in literature where this shows up as Pi Mass, and I don't know why Christmas is called that. So if you want an answer to the question, you can write a paper on it. I haven't been able to find it, but I've done work on it. Okay? People ask me that question. My answer is, I don't know. Isn't this stuff fascinating, though? All right. Fourthly, the Lord alone, by his Spirit, made them to disrelish and cast off carnal debauched preachers, idle shepherds that cared not after the flock but the fleece, looking their gain from every quarter, that did not relish or savor what they preached, nor preach what they savor. Being thus blind, others' eyes were opened not to follow them. Fifthly, the Lord made them to embrace and adhere, to follow, love, and cleave to lively and powerful preachers. By giving the people a taste of his Spirit, they desired more, that they might grow thereby, and could not be content with the abominable broth that was not poured out by his Spirit. Sixthly, the Holy One, by pouring forth into the hearts of those that should be saved a more sanctified spirit, he made them cast off and leave the common road. They forsook profaning the Lord's Day and hearkening unto homilies of which they grew weary. Now, we'll talk about homilies later on. They're very important. Seventhly, they left off superstitious bowing at the name of Jesus and to the altar, which thing was plain and open idolatry, worshiping and adoring that which there is no show of precept for, but a direct and visible breach of the second commandment. Eighthly, they cast off the cross and other ceremonies at their sprinkling children, which was a good step. Now, this is kind of hilarious. Though the people could not see through to reform in that particular, cast off the thing of sprinkling itself, which was the mere... Now, here he has to run down the rabbit trail, you see. Which was the mere invention of men 300 years after Christ, not mentioned of in Tertullian's time, the fruit of the apostasy that the church fell into from one thing to another until at last they lost the substance of religion and kept only a shadow thereof. From baptizing souls, as they entered into the church in a river, they made a font and placed it in their public places near some great door. If you ever go to England, you'll find that in many of the cathedrals, the baptismal font is placed right near the door, symbolizing the entrance to the church. The baby would be baptized on the way in, picking it up again. In all such places signifying or resembling the entrance into the church. Secondly, from dipping the child in the font, they by degrees took up sprinkling them. Thirdly, from a font in process of time, they took a basin in their place called the church. Fourthly, from a basin in their church, they brought it to a basin in a house. Fifthly, from men, their parsons, to sprinkle, they allowed women to do it in case of necessity, as they called it, to seal their wills and seal that which they never read by the party's profession or confession or saw by their conversation. Thus, leaving the examples in Holy Scripture and the commands of the Lord, in vain do they worship Him, teaching for doctrines the commandments of men, Mark 7:7, or traditions of men, setting up their posts by the Lord's. What do you think he thinks about infant baptism and sprinkling? Ninthly, though the Lord for a time winked at the times of these ignorances in that thing, He made them cast off the use of pictures and images, and they could not bear to hear any preacher plead for that old scrap and relic of idolatry, so much like pleading for Baal. Tenthly, the Lord wrought so upon their spirits that they would not kneel at the sacrament, because the example in Holy Scriptures was sitting at the Lord's Supper, although it was pleaded against them that so solemn an ordinance was to be done with a great deal of reverence, and kneeling was a reverence to God. But a reverence and decency that God hath not commanded must not be observed, to make void the example or command. The pattern must be kept. Remember, God's altar must not be made of hewn stone, which to man was more decent, so that this small thing in the eye of many was great strength to the godly that left it off. They that make conscience in doing small things will be made thereby stronger and enabled to do greater, for he that hath clean hands shall wax stronger and stronger in the Lord. Notice, he uses the word godly to refer to them, not the word Puritan, but godly. That's one of the self-identifiers that was used by these men. All right. Eleventhly, how often in your preaching do you get to go to eleventhly or twelfthly? They cast off hearing the common prayer, that nurse of formality and chain of security. Many persons, by reading thereof without searching their hearts and leaving off sin, they would lick themselves whole in their thoughts or esteem, like the harlot in the Proverbs who said, "I have paid my vows. Come, let us sin and be vain." Not regarding whether their spirits received any divine impress upon them, being broken and humbled in the presence of the Lord. So the Spirit of the Lord quenched, and no room to breathe from the sense of their present miscarriages or wants, whether consolation or humiliation. Twelfthly, they were hoping by the Lord to cast off this also and to step this further in their reformation, that at last they would not hear those men that did read common prayer, that did thereby declare themselves to own or partake in any part consentingly to the worship of the beast. Now, those are his 12 steps. Now, notice what he does next. This is fascinating stuff. I think this is really amazing. Notice his next point. Thus, I have briefly recited 12 steps that doth complete a demonstration that they, this church... Now, stop. Where did he begin? He began on the continent, didn't he? With Calvin and Luther. He doesn't name them, but that's clearly who he's talking about. Then he talks about Henry VIII. Okay? Thus I've briefly recited 12 steps that doth complete a demonstration that they, this church, in their beginning, were truly reformed in a great measure in turning from the worship of Antichrist, and it is prayed and hoped the Lord will, in his due time, not only turn them from Antichrist, but that he will also turn them perfectly to himself and make them so to wait upon him until he come, Revelation 2:25, 22:20. That's the end of Terrell's 12 points. Now, I find this stuff fascinating, and it helps me to see. Now, Terrell is not claiming that they've come to the end. This last statement says he's praying that the Lord will lead them further on. But he's glad for what the Lord has done, and he believes that his congregation, the Broadmead Bristol Particular Baptist Church, is the fruit of the Reformation that began 150 years before in the continent, came over through Henry VIII, and here it is. Here we are. Fascinating stuff. This is their self-identity. This is how they're thinking. And this characterizes Puritanism. You see, his ties are to the Reformation, and that's what the Puritans would have said about themselves. Now, I want to continue on with my review and talk about the precursors. Basically, my outline will follow the monarchs of England with just one deviation here along the way. And I realized that I had not kept up with my outline here on the board, and I apologize for that. So actually where we're at, we talked about two of the precursors. We did Terrell. The Lollards, and then this is Terrell, and now C is Henry VIII. I'm still under Terrell. Then we're going to come to C, will be Tyndale in just a minute. Well, I want to say some things right now about Henry VIII, since he was introduced by Edward Terrell. We'll have a lot more to say about Henry and all of the rest of the monarchs later in the week. This, as we said, is just an overview. Henry is well known for the fact that he had six wives. His first wife, Catherine of Aragon, she was apparently happily married to him for about 25 years. But when she didn't produce a male heir, of course, back then they thought that it was the woman's task to produce the male. When she did not do so, and for other less noble, really more sinful reasons, Henry set his eyes upon a young woman named Anne Boleyn. Then he married Jane Seymour, then Anne of Cleves, then Catherine Howard, and finally Catherine Parr, six wives. He had been given or granted the title Defender of the Faith. Now, that's a really interesting title, and we'll say more about it later on. But the reason that he was given that title is that he wrote a book against Martin Luther, and Martin Luther's views of the sacrament. And the Pope was so pleased with this book that Henry had written that he granted to him the official title Defender of the Faith. And since then, all of the English monarchs have carried that title, which was granted to them by the Pope. Now, after about 25 years of marriage, Henry sought an annulment of his first marriage from the Pope. What happened was basically this. Henry was actually the second son of his father and not the first heir to the throne. He had an older brother whose name was Arthur. And Arthur, what I've read about Arthur, everything about him, they say, was very good, a man of noble character and ability and all. But Arthur, when he was a teenager, came down sick and died. And Henry was then next in line for the throne and at the right time came to the throne. Arthur had originally been engaged to marry Catherine of Aragon. And when Henry came to the throne, he was set up with Catherine, who was his brother's ex-fiancée. Now, the Archbishop of Canterbury, William Warham, had matters of conscience about the rightness of Henry marrying Catherine, but he allowed the marriage to go ahead anyways, and they were married for about 25 years. But when Henry sought to do away with the marriage, it technically wasn't a divorce, it was an annulment, which he sought from the Pope. Because at that point, Henry decided that the marriage had actually been incestuous and should never have taken place and therefore should be annulled as no genuine marriage. Now, there are all kinds of complicating factors involved, including the fact that Catherine's uncle was Charles V, the Holy Roman Emperor, and he had a whole lot of pull with the Pope, and the Pope came to realize that if he granted the annulment to Henry, he would probably offend Charles V, and everyone who was affiliated with him in the Holy Roman Empire. And so the Pope chose to let Henry go rather than to grant the annulment to Henry. Now, when that happened, Henry thumbed his nose at the papacy, and he declared himself supreme head of the Church of England on earth. Now, in the light of what Edward Terrell has said to us, that break with Rome, where the Pope refused to grant the annulment and Henry said, we'll go our own way, that break started the work of Reformation in England. In 1534, Henry published, with the assent of Parliament, the Act of Supremacy, and it declared this: the King's Majesty justly and rightly is and ought to be and shall be reputed the only supreme head in earth of the Church of England called Anglicana Ecclesia. Now, that's a very strong statement, is it not? But that's the declaration that came forth from Henry. Now, the changes, the religious changes that were made under Henry were really minor, but they set the stage for more significant developments over the next 150 years. Henry only had one legitimate son, whose name was Edward VI, and he was the son of Jane Seymour. When Henry died in 1547, Edward came to the throne, but he was only 9 years old. And so it was necessary for a regency to be appointed effectively to govern England in the name of Edward. And he only reigned for 6 years, dying in 1553 at the age of 15. Because he was a minor, his reign was through a regency council, and this council was amenable to the Protestant reforms that had been begun under Archbishop Thomas Cranmer. And so for the first time under Edward VI, the Protestant cause was established as the faith of England. But a whole lot more needs to be said about that, and we will say it as the week follows. Now, let us see here in the outline William Tyndale. Let's say a few words about Tyndale. We're still talking about precursors here, okay? Tyndale was an English scholar and reformer, and he sought permission to translate the Bible into vernacular English, but it was denied by Bishop Tunstall. Tyndale worked in London and then on the continent, and he produced and printed a full New Testament in English in 1526. Copies were smuggled into the United Kingdom. Cardinal Wolsey, who was not the Archbishop of Canterbury, but really was the most powerful cleric in England, proclaimed that Tyndale was a heretic and ordered that he be arrested. Tyndale wrote against Henry's divorce and annulment proceedings, and he incurred the wrath of the king. He was arrested in Antwerp, in what is now Belgium, in 1535. And was martyred gruesomely in the next year. But Tyndale's great work of translation, combined with several other important theological works, provided an English model and backdrop for Puritan resistance to royal interference in matters of faith and practice. Now, all that we're saying right here is that there are little steps being made forward, tiny steps being made forward, individuals who are coming forth. And sometimes, as in the case of Tyndale, these individuals suffered terribly for what they did. But in doing these things, they paved the way for further reformation to come to the Church of England. All right? Now, let's skip a little ahead a little bit. Number three in my outline here under number C. We're going to have a lot of numbers now because I'm going to run through in consecutive order a series of historical events. Number three is the Vestiarian controversy. We have a slide here, if you could put it up on the internet, Jeremy, a picture of John Hooper, who became the Bishop of Gloucester. Hooper returned from exile after Henry's reign and resisted consecration as a bishop in vestments. Now, you see in this picture that he is wearing the vestments. You see the surplice the white gown. It's underneath a black stole at this point, but you can tell that he is wearing the surplice. This led to a long debate over the legitimacy of requiring clerics to wear the surplice, or if they're bishops, to wear the cope, and whether or not it was proper for them to use them. That is, were they a thing indifferent and thus permissible in the worship of God, or were they a violation of God's worship? That was the question that came about through the Vestiarian controversy, 1548. John Hooper here is the key figure. Ultimately, with Calvin and Bullinger urging him not to make too much of the issue. Now, if you read Calvin's letter, he says that the insistence of the English church upon the surplice and the cope was a silly thing. But he also tells Hooper that it's a matter that he ought not to stand upon, and urges him to go ahead and submit to ordination in the vestments. And in fact, Hooper did that. But the controversy introduced a significant issue and a major question, and it's simply this: was the Church of England in need of further reformation? We've already said that Puritanism needs to be understood as the English version of continental Protestantism, or of pan-European Protestantism. Now the question is, does that pan-European Protestantism need to bring its influence fully to bear upon the Church of England so that it moves forward in matters of reformation? That's the issue that is confronted in 1648 and its aftermath. Number four, Bloody Mary, or Queen Mary the First. Soon the issue was moot, because after Edward's death in 1553, his half-sister, she was older than he, but he was the male heir, and so he went to the head of the line. But he was the only male heir. As a result, when he died, his half-sister, Mary, ascended to the throne. Now, she was a committed Romanist. From the heart, she was a thoroughgoing and committed Romanist. And she sought to restore papal religion to England. In her brief reign of 5 years, she was responsible for the martyrdom of nearly 300 Protestants. And her policies drove many English divines to the reformed cities of the continent. Now, like her brother, she had no heirs. And when she died in 1558, probably of cancer of some kind, she was succeeded by her half-sister, also Edward's half-sister, Elizabeth I. When Elizabeth came to the throne, the exiles who had experienced reformed religion in its details, many of them embracing both the doctrine and practice of the continental churches, returned to England and brought with them their practice. So that leads us, fifthly, to Elizabeth I. Now, Elizabeth's reign is sometimes called the Via Media, or the Middle Way. That is, a church that is halfway between Rome and, let's say, Geneva. A church that's halfway in between. Elizabeth reigned for about 50 years. And her long reign began with hope and promise for Protestants, because she promoted a policy that was more like her brother Edward than her sister Mary. That is, she seemed at first to be amenable to a forward movement of Protestant faith in the Church of England. Her acceptance of certain Protestant tenets was more political than theological, and her failure to press on with Reformation in the Church of England produced the Puritan movement within the Church, and as we'll see, a growing separatist movement outside of the Church. Now, notice that what I just said. At this point, I'm still thinking of Puritanism as something within the Church. Separatism goes beyond. It goes outside. So Puritanism is trying to reform the Church of England. Separatism goes outside. These men had spent time on the continent, in Strasbourg, in Geneva, in Frankfurt. They had witnessed city-states where the Reformation was able to go forward in its fullness. And they were pleased with the results of the churches in which they had spent time. They returned to England. They had some reason to believe that Elizabeth would open the doors and allow further Reformation to come in the Church of England, but they were sadly disappointed. As a result, these men were involved in the process of seeking to further that activity within the church. Now, Elizabeth was not a heart-committed Protestant, but she also moved the Church of England away from Rome. She didn't take it back. She moved it away from Rome and adopted a middle-of-the-road policy in ecclesiastical matters. Now, there are two things that are worth mentioning. The Act of Supremacy in 1559 and the 1559 Act of Uniformity. Let's talk briefly about each of these. In 1559, Elizabeth basically reissued her father's edict in the 1559 Act of Supremacy, establishing the Church of England's independency from Rome and naming the monarch. At that point, it happened to be her, but it was written in such a way that any of her heirs or successors would be the head of the Church of England. And in 1559, the Act of Uniformity, which sought to promote a unified policy of faith and practice within the church. Now, there's something that we have to understand about the 1559 circumstances. Because the monarch, in this case the queen, makes a decision stating that the church is Protestant, does that change the heart and the belief of all of the Roman priests out in the parishes of the Church of England? See, it doesn't change them at all. They're still the same. The monarch says, yesterday you were Roman, today you're Protestant, but their beliefs are the same. The Act of Uniformity, which included the Book of Common Prayer and the Book of Homilies. Now, the homilies will take on importance later on in our story. But these were put together by Protestant theologians, and they were imposed upon the churches so that there would be, theoretically, in every one of the parishes, a Protestant testimony, even though it came forth from a priest or a minister who was technically a Romanist. Or not technically, but was in heart a Romanist, you see. He had to read these homilies, which were Protestant sermons. He had to read from the Book of Common Prayer. And this was the only means that they had available to them by which they could be ensured that in some sense the Church of England was Protestant. What else do you do? Do you throw out all of them? You don't have anybody who can go into those parishes, you see. There is no one who is able to go to those places and minister to those people. And so from above, there's a kind of reformation that is imposed from above in the 1559 Act of Uniformity, which says, do this. And if these men who yesterday were priests and are now ministers of the Church of England are willing and able to be subject to the royal order, they will read to their people from a Protestant book and Protestant sermons. That's better than the guy performing the Mass and having no preaching at all. Okay? So we have to understand that at the beginning, the intention of this was positive. Now, it gets turned around in 20 years. We'll see this later on. It turns against them. But in the beginning, in a sense, there wasn't much else that they could have done. And this was an attempt to find some way in which they could be assured that there was not Romanism that was being taught. Now, she leaned heavily on her advisors, and she promoted this policy that we've called the Via Media, the middle way. Though Romanism was outlawed, the Church of England maintained many of the outward trappings of Romanism. That is, ministers were told that they had to wear the surplice. Consecrated wafers were to be used at the communion of the Lord's table. And when these things were maintained in the Church of England, those men who had spent time on the continent were offended because the churches of the continent didn't practice in this way. And so as a result, Puritanism was beginning to take shape as men pressed for practices they witnessed among, and here's a very important phrase, the best Reformed churches of the continent. You'll see that phrase frequently, the best Reformed churches. It's often in phrases such as the example of the best Reformed churches. Now, usually what they mean by that is Geneva and Strasbourg, Zurich, because they thought very highly of Bullinger. There's a great deal of correspondence that goes on between the English reformers and Bullinger in Zurich. And also Scotland. Scotland is considered to be one of the best Reformed churches. So they're looking to Scotland as well as they're looking to the churches of the continent. All right? Now, we're still talking about Elizabeth's reign. But let me give you an exemplar in a man named Robert Browne, Browne. As we've said, many of those who had been exiles during the reign of Mary had seen the vigor of church life in the Reformed cities of the continent, and they pressed for the application of the principles of Scripture. See, they believed that Scripture was being taken seriously and its principles were being applied in those churches. They pressed for the application of the principles of Scripture in the life of the Church of England. They were committed to the idea of a national church. They believed in the Church of England, but they wanted it to be reformed along some kind of Presbyterian pattern. Now, Presbyterianism is still in its early stages, okay? But some kind of Presbyterian pattern, like they saw in places such as Geneva, they wanted these things to be present in the Church of England. Now, there were some, such as Thomas Cartwright. You may have heard his name before, very important early Puritan. He took a long view, and he sought to change gradually, by small steps, the doctrines and practices of the national church. It's as if Cartwright was thinking, maybe my son or my grandson will see a Reformed Church of England. Maybe I won't in my life, but I'm willing to go slowly so that we can see the end result at some point. But there were others who were not so patient, and one of them is Robert Browne. In 1582, Browne published a very famous book entitled A Treatise of Reformation Without Tarrying for Any. Now, the title tells you what the book is about. Okay? He's impatient. Someone has called him a hasty Puritan. He articulated the concerns of a growing number of his fellow countrymen. That is, that the Church of England was a corrupt remnant of Roman dominance, and it could not be reformed. It would be impossible to bring a full-blown pattern and program of reformation to the Church of England. Therefore, it needed to be abandoned. And in its place, new local churches must be established in conformity to the patterns found in the New Testament. You throw it all out and start again. And he does that by means of separation. Now, the writings of Browne had a tremendous impact on many, solidifying separatist convictions and giving impetus to those who agreed that the Church of England could not be salvaged. Now, strangely, Browne later in his life returned to the national church. He repented of what he wrote and submitted. Again, he was a Cambridge graduate. He had been episcopally ordained. He was a minister in the Church of England. He went out as a separatist, later repented of his views, and came back in, was welcomed back into the Church of England. So the main theorist goes back, but his writings have a powerful influence on many, and his decisive works and his decisive action set the example for others. So you'll come across names like John Penry, Henry Barrow, Francis Johnson, Henry Ainsworth. Some of you might have Ainsworth's notes on the Pentateuch. John Robinson, who was the pastor of the Mayflower Pilgrims. These men followed his lead. And what we see happening, beginning in the 1580s, is the establishment of a series of separatist churches outside of the Church of England and largely condemning the Church of England. They begin to use very strong language, calling the Church of England Antichrist, saying that no true Christian should maintain his participation in or membership in the Church of England. Everyone should leave, come out from among them, and be separate. So now, starting in the 1580s, in a sense you have two tracks, you see. You have the Puritans within, who are seeking to bring Reformation within. Maybe they take the long view. And then you have the separatists who have already moved outside. And in moving outside, say, we don't want anything to do with the Church of England.
Thank you for listening to the Weekly Discourse. If you've been blessed by this week's discourse, please consider subscribing to the Man of God Network so that you can continue to be blessed with resources like these. If you'd like to learn more about Covenant Baptist Theological Seminary, visit us at cbtseminary.org.